أمتهم. Jesus is only the messenger of Allah and His word, and He's not God.
Right.
So one case that happens in Christianity is the concept of Trinity and the claim that Jesus is God.
So the manifestation of Qulub for Christians is mentioned in the Holy Quran.
That's right. I mean, one of them at least.
One of them, okay.
And also Ma'idah 77, Ya Ahlul Kitab La Taghlu Fi Dinikum. So this is the point that unfortunately some cases when, I will talk about the origins of Qulub exaggeration, but one of them is too much love for a person, and which leads to people transgress the limits.
Yes.
And this discussion is the topic of ghulub exaggeration is explained in various Islamic disciplines.
That's right.
So sometimes it's discussed in kalam, theology, because we need to know the true status of the prophets and our prophet and the imams, not to go to extremes. The other discipline is ilm al-rajal. Mm-hmm. We know that when it comes to each and every hadith narration, we need to check the chain of the
narrations
one by one.
Okay.
So one of the issues that make a person, a narrator, not reliable, not thiqa, is exaggeration.
Exaggeration,
so if in ilm al-rajal there are discussions about some narrators who are among the ghulat. And of course, in fiqh, in jurisprudence, there is also a discussion about whether a ghali, an exaggerator, is a believer or not.
So when we are talking about a narrator being an exaggerator, what do we mean exactly? I mean, what specifications his narrations have to be considered among the ghulat, Sheikh?
So to answer your question, we may talk about different examples of ghulub, what makes a person a ghali, an exaggerator, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we have people exaggerating regarding divinity.
All right.
So to, for example, believe that a human being is God. As I mentioned, this is what we see in Christianity. And among the Muslims and among the Shia, we have had in the past some groups who believed in the divinity of, for example, Imam Ali alayhi salam in a sect known as Sabaiyya. And there is another sect called Khattabiyya. They believed in the divinity of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. So this is one example of ghulub, to believe that one human being is God, which is absolutely rejected by the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. Or for example, we have a sect known as Ithnainiyya.
Mm-hmm.
They believed both in divinity of the Prophet and Imam Ali alayhi salam. So this is one case, one example, one application of the term ghulub. We have had some groups who believe that, na'udhubillah, some of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt or all of them and the Prophet, they share divinity with God. Now, our dear listeners, if they refer to books of hadith, sometimes they come to the term known as tafwil. So there are two cases that tafwil is used. One is when there is a discussion on free will and predestination. We have Asha'ira who believed in predestination, and we have Mu'tazila who believed in tafwil, and the Shia who believe in al-amru bayn al-amrayn, neither absolute freedom nor absolute predestination. But the other case that tafwid is used is regarding a minority among the Shia. Of course, in the past, they do not exist anymore. They believe that God has created this world and then has given or has delegated the lordship to the Prophet and the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, more especially. So, for example, creation, death, giving sustenance, all these were given by God to these people, was delegated. And delegated means to do tafwil, right? So this is another example of ghulub. The third is to believe in a kind of incarnation or indwelling of God in a human being. Or, for example, there is a union between a human being and God. We have had, for example, in a group among Kaysaniya who believe that the Spirit of God has incarnated in Prophet or Imam Ali alayhi salam or Muhammad bin Hanafiya. Also, to believe that someone is the Son of God, this is another type of exaggeration, yes. As some Christians believe that Jesus is Son of God, and according to the Quran, some Jewish people believe that Uzair is Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when it comes to Mahdism, to believe that some people who were ordinary people, yes, are the promised Mahdi, like, I mean, this is another type, that's right, of exaggeration. In the past, in the history of Islam, we had, as I mentioned, Kaysaniya, who believed in Muhammad bin Hanafiya to be the promised Mahdi, or Nafs Zakiya. They did not, I mean, these people may have not claimed Mahdism, but other people claim that these are the promised Mahdi. So some people believe in Muhammad bin Abdullah bin Hassan, known as Nafs Zakiya, to be the promised Mahdi.
IRIB English Radio presents questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Answering your theological questions in questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Send us your questions to EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
So in Sufism, or in some part of the Tasawwuf, also we can say the exaggeration in the character of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Some of them
is over there, that Ali is God or something like that. And the non-Shias accuse Shias of shirk or something like that. Or, for example, Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam. So exaggerations exist everywhere. In all sects, in all denominations of all religions, we have exaggerations. But is it clear why? I mean, why such people might exaggerate about their figures, the holy figures?
At least when it comes to our case, I mean, exaggeration within the religion of Islam, and some of these factors can be extended to other religions, we can think of different factors. Sometimes the historical sources give us this impression that sometimes there were political motives behind this phenomenon of exaggeration.
All right.
Meaning that, I mean, some exaggerators were not, for example, true Shia, true Muslims. They just became within the community of the Shia, and then to exaggerate about the Imams so that, politically speaking, they could turn away other people from the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And that is one of the reasons that we see a very, very serious reaction of the Imams from Imam Ali alayhi salam onward against the exaggerators.
That's right.
They were very serious against them. Sometimes the Imams cursed the exaggerators and asked the Shia to, I mean, be away from such people.
All right.
I mean, pay attention to their children, not to associate with the exaggerators. So political motivation is one of them. We may call backwardness, intellectual backwardness, as another reason. As I mentioned, sometimes people, I mean, love someone, but they go to extreme out of their ignorance.
That's right.
And the other point is, worldly motivations.
Mm-hmm.
We have had in the history of Islam that some people, of course, very few in number, they try to exaggerate about some of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam so that they could continue to work as their deputies and representative and collect some money from the people.
Okay.
So these are some of the factors mentioned as the sources, as the factors, reasons for exaggeration. But as I mentioned, we should not forget about the fact that in some cases we should take into consideration the role of the enemies of Islam and the enemies of the Shias.
Mm-hmm.
They try to educate some people and then send them as, let's call it, spies among the Shias, among the Muslims, so that they go to extreme, they have some exaggerative claims, and they mislead the people. Mm-hmm. And in the last maybe two centuries, we need also to take into consideration the role of the superpowers, the colonialists, okay? They also had some role in it to mislead some individuals and send them as, their deputies, their spies among the religious communities, and they mislead the people. So these are some of the various factors, mm-hmm. and I believe, all of us should take care of that. We need to take our religion from the true Shia scholars.
Yes, authentic
we need
resources,
to refer to the Quran, the narrations, to know the true status of the Prophet and the Imams, and not to go to extreme regarding that.
That's right. Okay. So, and sometimes going to extremism will lead to superstition, Sheikh.
Sure.
Something which is believed by the masses and public people, you know, something, some powers which are attributed, for example, to prophets or the Imams, which Imam themselves, as you said, criticized truly at their time when they were living. About Mahdism, this is so. Because Imam is a major occultician, so many false claimants will attribute something which is unauthentic to the holy Imam. That's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of ghulat or exaggerators. Ghulat is the plural form of ghali, means exaggerator. It was very kind of you, Sheikh. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to this episode of Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. Please, for more information, visit our website, iranradio.ir. To another episode, we leave you in Allah's care. Goodbye. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the Hall of Shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history. Should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. America gives the go-ahead.
then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice, our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. The thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too
ocean of dua.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith, and all of you who are listening to RIB English Radio. You're listening to the program, The Ocean of Dua. And this program, we try to discuss the different concepts and meanings and try to interpret the passages of different supplications that have been issued by the Ma'sumin, peace be upon them. We were continuing the discussion on the supplication of Sabah, Dua al-Sabah, and let's listen to one passage of this supplication, and we'll be right back, and we'll talk more about that passage.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. اللهم يا من دلع لسان الصباح بنطق تبلجي وسرح قطع الليل المظلم بغياهب تلجلجي وأتقن صنع الفلك الدوار في مقادير تبرجي وشعشع ضياء الشمس بنور تأججي.
This is RIB English Radio. You just listened to one passage of the supplication of Sabah. The Imam says in this passage, he's praying to Allah, he's supplicating Allah, and he is asking Allah for all of the good things that Allah can bestow upon his servants. He is swearing by different things, different signs of Allah. He is saying, oh Allah, you are the one who does this. You are the one who causes the morning to appear to us, for the sun to rise, for the darkness to be covered with light once again. And this process keeps repeating And it is you who is causing this. It's not happening randomly or by chance. In this passage, the Imam says, وَأَتْقَنَ صُنْعَ الْفَلَكِ الدَّوَّارِ فِي مَقَادِيرِ تَبَرُّجِ. Once again, وَأَتْقَنَ صُنْعَ الْفَلَكِ الدَّوَّارِ فِي مَقَادِيرِ تَبَرُّجِ. And you made firm the structure. Okay, here it says, of the turning spheres and the measure of its display. This is not an accurate translation because felek does not mean sphere necessarily. It means a line of orbit. It means what in English we would say constellation. The rotating constellation, the circulating constellation that is happening every single day and night around the North Star or Polaris, the North Pole Star. You are the one who has made firm these stars, and you are the one who is causing them to circulate in the sky. And all of these, they have fine calculations. في مقادير تبرج. Like we are seeing the stars for thousands of years. We've seen the same stars go around us without any one of them falling out of orbit. So how is that possible? Who is holding these stars in place? Who has structured these stars other than Allah? So Allah is the one who has made the heavens and the earth, the seven heavens, all of the stars that are like ornaments for the lowest heaven. Allah says in the Quran, Inna zayyanna samaa ad-dunya bi zinatin al-kawakib. So this verse says that the lowest heaven, which is the sky that we have, it has, it's adorned by the stars. They're like ornaments. The lowest heaven has samad. Now here, the translation for the Arabic verse, dunya, ad-dunya here means lowest or lower. It doesn't mean dunya as in this world. Some have mistranslated this verse saying that it's the heaven of the world. No, here ad-dunya means lower, just like akbar means greater. So what is the use of these falak ad-dawwar that Allah has placed in the sky with all of its measure and all of its beauty and display? Tabarruj, they're very beautiful. They light our sky every night, and we can see the same stars every single night without any one of them changing their place. Well, Allah says so that the ships, they know where they're sailing. This is one of the uses of the Falak ad-Dawwar that have been used for thousands of years by those who navigate the seas. Let's take a short break and we'll be right back.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the All Beneficent, the All Merciful. O Allah, O He who extended the morning sung in the speech of its dawning, dispatch the fragments of the dark night into the gloom of its stammering, made firm the structure of the turning spheres in the measure of its display, and beam forth the brightness of the sun through the light of its blazing.
Thank you, Allah,
now that we're here,
feeling so good
about
all the things that we went through.
You're listening to Arabi English Radio. This is the Ocean of Dua. We just read the passage وَأَتْقَنَ صُنْعَ الْفَلَكِ الدَّوَّارِ فِي مَقَادِيرِ تَبَرُّجِ. All of these are the signs of Allah. When we see all of these things that have been mentioned in this dua, we see night, the fragments of darkness. When we see or we hear the speech of the morning, the tongue of the morning, what is it? These are all the creation of Allah. They can't have happened out of chance and accident. Allah says, إن في خلق السماوات والأرض واختلاف الليل والنهار لآيات لأولي الألباب. So all of these things are signs of Allah. For who? الذين يذكرون الله قياما وقعودا وعلى جنوبهم ويتفكرون في خلق السماوات والأرض ربنا ما خلقت هذا باطلا سبحانك فقنا عذاب. They say that, oh Allah, you have not created these things in vain, like we're told, that we had a big bang and everything just came into being by accident, and we were made from monkeys, and we were first a really tiny cell, and gradually over the course of millions or billions of years, all of a sudden we became intelligent human beings, and there was no intelligence involved in our creation. And this is all nonsense. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Ocean of Dua. Until next time, I leave you in the care and mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we provide an in-depth analysis of Israel's criminal behaviour and the effort it puts into influencing international policymakers and global public opinion. In today's show, we'll be examining who's behind the crisis at the BBC and how this relates to the corporation's coverage of Palestine and Israel. In our first report, Atif Rabu Chakra explains the role played by BBC board member Robbie Gibb in fomenting the upheaval in Britain's supposedly public service broadcaster.
An Israel lobby coup has taken place at the BBC with the resignation of Director General Tim Davie and new CEO Deborah Turness. But why have the Scottish First Minister, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Ed Davie, and the union representing the largest number of BBC workers, Bechtu, responding to this news by calling for BBC board member Robbie Gibb to resign? Gibb was the key mover behind this coup and is working for foreign interests. He was part of a consortium which saved the Israel lobby rag, the Jewish Chronicle, alongside former chairman of the Charity Commission, William Shawcross, John Woodcock, former head of the Labour Friends of Israel, and Jonathan Sakadotti, former head of the Zionist Federation. Gibb was a co-founder of the rancid channel GB News, which has worked against the BBC from its very inception. Gibb also has a paid job for the Kext CNC PR company, founded by Israeli Gershon Kext, a chairman of the Weizmann Institute in Israel. Kext CNC is a subsidiary of Publicis Group, and according to an internal message from Global Chief Executive Officer Arthur Sadon, many staff have already been called up to the Israeli military for the genocide in Gaza. All of Gibb's media outlets outside of the BBC have been calling for Davie to resign for supposed pro-Palestinian bias for several years. Israel's Deputy Foreign Minister Sharon Haxel even publicly called for Tim Davie's resignation in June 2025. The primary catalyst for the resignations was a leaked internal dossier from Michael Prescott, a supposedly independent advisor to the BBC's editorial guidelines committee. This memo, leaked to the right-wing Daily Telegraph, specifically accused the BBC Arabic service of anti-Israel and pro-Hamas biases and minimizing Israeli suffering in its Gaza coverage. This report was set into motion by Gibb, who appointed Prescott to carry it out. Simultaneous to that, Prescott is employed by PR firm Hanover Communications, which works directly for Larry Ellison's Oracle firm. Ellison is so close to Netanyahu that he offered him directorship of Oracle and also is the highest individual donor to the Israeli military in history. The Board of Deputies has long expressed concerns about the BBC's anti-Israel bias and called for deep cultural change after the resignations, seeing them as the start of a renewal process. This was an Israel lobby coup.
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. Our guest contributor today is the author, broadcaster, investigative journalist, and former BBC insider, Tony Gosling. Welcome to the show. David, what do you know about this Robbie Gibb character and his role at the BBC?
Well, Robbie Gibb is the chief Zionist enforcer at the BBC. He's on the five-person editorial executive committee, which oversees all news and current affairs decisions. But he's not the only Zionist enforcer. There are many more, including on the executive committee. There are two or three others on the executive committee who are Zionists. And then further down the chain of command, there are many more in the newsroom, etc. But Gibb is a very interesting character. This is a guy who, of course, was involved with the Jewish Chronicle. The movement of the Jewish Chronicle from being an extremist Zionist organization to being an ultra-extremist Zionist organization. And of course, involved with, as the film showed there, with GB News. One of the interesting things about him, which is not widely known, is that he used to be a Western intelligence agent in the Soviet Union. Him and his brother, both of them. His brother, of course, has been in a kibbutz in Israel. It's said that they're not Jewish, but they were the CIA, it looks like, in the Soviet Union, involved with an organization which also had previously had MI6 involvement, but MI6 had pulled out of that. So this is a guy who's got intelligence links and, of course, now has been central to the takeover of the Jewish Chronicle, in fact, in charge of that takeover.
Wow. Well, Tony, I mean, the BBC has a history, doesn't it, of MI5 vetting its employees, but what's happened here differ from that?
Well, look, I think we have to understand what the BBC is and what broadcasting is, how it fits in to the rest of the world, because it's a relatively new thing to be able to broadcast live people speaking in the last 100 years, really. And so really what broadcasting is nowadays is a new thing, which is a like the nervous system of humanity. So people can in real time supposedly see what's going on in other parts of the world. And whether it works or not is in the 1920s set the BBC up, were aware that it could be used as a weapon of war. And that's why when they first started it, they came up with this slogan, nations shall speak peace unto nation, which was underneath the badge, you know, the sort of public BBC. And of course, it has actually, in my lifetime, I think, been co-opted. But MI5, you're quite right, that's Britain's internal security service, were exposed in the 1980s by Mark Hollingsworth as vetting all the staff. I managed to get in by other routes. Basically, I knew some people who were news producers in London and got in that way. But if you were to try and go through many of their official procedures, someone like me is unlikely to have managed to get into the BBC. MI5 most definitely involved in that. And I think we're now in the situation where that has become absolutely embedded in the corporation. You've got, not just the BBC, in other private broadcasters and newspapers in the capital. So, for example, home affairs correspondents will all be basically public relations people for MI5. Attached to the Home, the Foreign Affairs stable of journalists, all pretty much saying the same kind of thing, associated with an MI6 point of view. In terms of finance, we've got the UK budget this week. You'll find all of the London correspondents looking at finance are being told what to think by the City of London and vetted by the City of London. So what we've got does not reflect society whatsoever anymore. It just reflects these sorts of elite institutions, as you mentioned, like MI5.
Yes, indeed. And in terms of the Zionist impact, though, Attorney, just say a word about that. I mean, obviously, talk about the MI5, I mean, and you've sort of set that out very, very clearly. But just say, I mean, does this differ from what's gone before? I mean, what's going on now?
Well, okay, so I started at the BBC in the late 1980s as a researcher and then went on to do reporting and journalism. I was there at a very interesting time because in 1911, Victor Rothschild, who was part of the Rothschild family, a very influential Labour peer, spoke to Marmaduke Hussey, who writes about it in his autobiography, who was the chairman at the BBC at the time. And he said to Marmaduke Hussey, can I see the director? So that was what was going on in the Thatcher era, because Alastair Milne was the director general of the BBC, who's basically like the chief editor there. And he was doing programmes which were critical of the Thatcher government. They had a panorama which was exposing the far right within the Conservative Party. I found it interesting that it was actually Victor Rothschild that broached the subject of getting rid of that director general. And then they replaced him with Michael Checkland, who was an accountant, and then with John Burt, who was the director general when I was working there.
Let me just move on to David, though, now, if I may, Tony, because we haven't got too much time. And I just wanted to get your thoughts, David, about, I mean, Latifa, as we heard, referred to this guy, Michael Prescott, in her report. I mean, just say a bit more about his role.
Well, this is yet another of the very many issues corruption within these processes. So Prescott had a dual role. He was working to the BBC and also for this PR firm, which of course has got all sorts of other clients, including of course working for the big tech firms, including Oracle, run by Larry Ellison, the guy who's just taken over TikTok and CBS, yes, and is looking to take over other media platforms in the US, international media platforms. And of course, if they can, they want to take over as many media platforms as they can. And so that's what's behind this coup at the BBC, is an attempt to make sure that nobody in the mainstream media or in social media is able to be critical of the genocide.
Right, okay. Well, Tony, I mean, why do you think Israel and its lobby groups then are so fixated on the BBC?
Well, of course, it's because they want to create the impression that what the Israelis are doing is correct and right. Back in the 1990s, we had Zionists appearing in our newsroom. They come from outside broadcasting. They're, you know, it was questionable whether they were actually competent broadcasters, but they were pro-Israel. And there were lots of people raising eyebrows around our production office, Marylebone High Street, at Greater London Radio at the time, to see these people popping out of nowhere. So the process, I think, began in the late 1980s, early 1990s, of including these kind of basically Zionist agents. The idea really, I think, is to manipulate the public opinion. In fact, on a couple of occasions, I've had producers say to me, well, we haven't told the public what to think yet. And so there's an enormous amount of power in this whole broadcasting idea. But remember, they're speaking to less and less people. If you look at the Press Gazette's annual returns, you'll find that now it's a steady two-thirds, 65-70% of people in Britain don't trust what they see in the mass media anymore.
No,
and so they've lost about two-thirds of the people.
I think that probably explains one of the reasons why the Zionist entity has lost the battle for public opinion, Tony. And I guess, you know, obviously the BBC still likes to trade on its sort of reputation, as it were, as being a trustworthy source. And maybe that's another reason why the Zionist entity is so fixated on it. But David, I mean, the Middle East, BBC's Middle East editor of their news website, Rafi Berg, I mean, just say a bit about him, will you, and his role in all this as well.
Well, I mean, Berg is clearly a very important element of this, but he's not the only one. I mean, there are Zionists spread throughout the corporation, and these are effectively Zionist gatekeepers. But Rafi Berg has become the most well-known because there's been stories about him, and of course there's this recent libel action which he is taking against Owen Jones, which I think is almost guaranteed to fail. But Berg is a fan of Netanyahu. He's written about the derring do of the Mossad, and he still remains in there as a kind of gatekeeper, along with many other Zionist gatekeepers inside the BBC, like there is in almost all of the other mainstream media outlets.
And Tony, just get your thoughts, really, on this libel action that David just mentioned, that Rafi Berg's taken against the Guardian columnist Owen Jones. What's your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, people like Rafi Berg are literally embedded now within, it's almost like in the brain cells of humanity. They're making sure that they're acting like, David said, as gatekeepers. This is their job. Anyone who gets through, it stops anyone getting through. I remember hearing from Craig Murray, who I know is a friend of yours, how several times there are taxis taking him to a television centre to appear on a live television programme, and then the taxi driver has to turn around and take him back because somebody like Rafi, although he's an internet guy actually, has intervened. Yeah. I mean, that seems to me to be the whole role nowadays of many of these specific individuals. And they don't reflect the humanity. I am very concerned, though, about this attack on the BBC at the moment, because we've got a privately owned all the time, and the BBC is really the only counter to it from the public sector. And what we've seen over the years is cross-media ownership and a handful of media proprietors. We've just got the Daily Telegraph being taken over by Daily Mail and General Trust at the moment. It's falling into fewer and fewer hands. And it's not just broadcasters or radio or newspapers. It's also magazines and books, all forms of media.
Yeah.
In fact,
Tony, we're going to have to just move to our next report now, which looks at the fallout following the BBC's coverage of the Glastonbury Music Festival earlier this year.
Under international law, the right of people under colonial or foreign domination and foreign occupation to resist by all available means, including armed struggle, has been widely recognized and affirmed by numerous United Nations General Assembly resolutions. International law explicitly sanctions the targeting of occupying soldiers through armed operations. As occupied people, the Palestinians have the right to resist the Israeli occupation through armed resistance. However, punk rap duo Bob Villain has faced significant backlash and professional consequences, including canceled shows and revoked visas. Following pro-Palestinian comments made during their Glastonbury Festival set in June 2025. During their performance, lead singer Bobby Villain led the crowd in chants of Free, Free Palestine and Death, Death to the IDF. This reflects the view of numerous UN resolutions that Palestinians have the right to protect themselves against occupying soldiers through armed force. This incident at Glastonbury was used as a weapon to force Davy out of the BBC. Performance was live-streamed by the BBC, which later expressed regret for not cutting the feed, and it triggered a police investigation. Following a rabid Israeli lobby campaign, the band was dropped from several festivals and tours, including Radar Festival in Manchester, a show in France, and a German tour. In October 2025, they postponed two headline UK gigs in Manchester and Leeds, citing political pressure from figures like Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson and Zionist groups who called for the gigs to be cancelled. The U.S. State Department also revoked the duo's visa, forcing the cancellation of their North American tour. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Christopher Landau stated that
foreigners who glorify violence and hatred are not welcome visitors to our country.
Their booking agent, United Talent Agency, UTA, also ended its relationship with the duo. Bob Villain's lead singer has stated he is not regretful of the chance and would do it again. In a statement, the band clarified that they're not calling for the death of Jews, Arabs, or any other race or group of people, but rather for the dismantling of a violent military machine, and that they are being targeted for speaking up. The rancid push to punish the group has been led by UK Lawyers for Israel and featured other less well-known lobby groups also. This call from the stage at Glastonbury featured heavily in the campaign against the BBC and was successfully used to force the resignation of Tim Davy, despite his capitulation after the fact. The UK Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer even joined in condemning the comments as appalling hate speech, adding to the pressure on venues. Despite the campaign, both Palestinian resistance and Bob Villain still stand. The BBC, however, is a contested space.
Well, David, I mean, is what Bob Villain said actually controversial in your opinion?
Well, it's become a very, very popular worldwide slogan. You hear it in demonstrations all over the world.
Yeah.
And of course, it was something which was unusual in the British public sphere, not so much in America at the time, but in the British public sphere at the time. But it's become, they said when they did it, well, let's not have any more vanilla slogans, let's have something serious. And that, and he was making a serious point about the need to dismantle the so-called Israel Defense Forces. And of course, that's what most young people now believe is necessary as a matter of simply of policy.
Yeah.
So not controversial in that sense, but of course very controversial in the parallel universe of Zionist sense-making. And that, of course, causes them to clutch their pearls and lose all their combobulation and of course, to try and stop him and the duo from playing anywhere, including, in Manchester, and a whole panoply of Zionist organisations got together for that.
That they used to silence opposition. But, Tony, when it comes to Israel, I mean, why does the BBC and the UK's corporate media seem to be so opposed to the application of international law?
Well, the fact is, I don't think they really are. It's just the people at the very top. If you look at the BBC's executive and its board, the foreign countries such as Israel take a great deal of interest in who is on those parts of the organisation and what their views are. And they're constantly trying to manoeuvre their people into those positions. But I think there will be many people in the BBC who will be cheering, privately maybe, without their bosses seeing, about Bobby Villain's comments in the summer. And isn't it interesting how that came out through the music and entertainment arm? Because the current affairs arm and the news arm of the BBC is so totally controlled. What we should be seeing is people like Glenn Deason, Jeffrey Sachs, Colonel Douglas McGregor, Scott Ritter on the news every evening. Very good experts. But they're being gatekept by people like Bobby Villain. And the other thing to mention is it's great to see live performances, live television, live radio, etc. is far cheaper to produce than pre-recorded, but they like to pre-record everything nowadays, even though it's much more expensive, because then they can control it.
They can control
things they don't want to see.
No, indeed. Let me just move on to you, David. I mean, what do you know about this United Talent Agency then that dropped Bob Villain after the Glastonbury Festival?
Well, this is one of a number of talent agencies based in the US, and in common with much of the entertainment industry, there's an iron grip of Zionist executives at the top of it. One of its first attempts to make sure that no one would mention Palestine was when it dropped Susan Sarandon in late 2023, and of course they've dropped Bob Villain now. This is part of the way in which Zionists are able to control entertainment firms, Hollywood movie companies, the music industry itself. Zionists at the top of all of these companies, and this is something which we, of course, have remarked on this show before, but it's something which people don't understand very well, that actually the Zionists are able to actually run these companies and are massively overrepresented at the top of them.
Yes, indeed, and when we point that out, and people point that out, they sort of accuse us of indulging in anti-Semitism. It's
of course
an extraordinary state of affairs, isn't it? But Tony, in the past, I know that you made the assertion that before entering frontline politics, Tony Blair was NMI5 asset who was spying on the campaign for nuclear disarmament. I mean, do you still stand by that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, this all came out in conversations with the former MI5 officer, Annie Machon. She actually spoke to the editor of the Sunday Times, and they knew, Blair knew, that people from MI5 were out speaking in her and her former partner, David Shaler. And Blair was incredibly nervous because he knew that they may have seen his MI5 files. They keep these things very secret. And so he was really scared. So, yes, definitely, this is a massive interference in democratic politics, the secret services nowadays, who, of course, are a kind of form of permanent government. And they have got so arrogant that they just think that they can direct political affairs. And as you can see around the world, particularly in the West here, you see similar laws being passed in all sorts of countries and a mass increase in mass.
Yes, it's indeed.
So difficult for institutions to carry on. It's because all of the people at the top of those institutions, whether it be journalists, politicians or whatever, are all under surveillance constantly.
Yeah. Well, David, I mean, just going back to Bob Villain then, I mean, do you think he's likely to be charged?
No, I mean, we've seen a lot of these kinds of threats in the last year against anti-Zionists, and almost all of them have come to nothing. I mean, there was the alleged charges that were going to be thrown at NECAP, who are the ones whose live show at Glastonbury was removed, and Bob Villain replaced it. And, of course, that's what led to that whole story. So, no, I mean, Bob Villain is not going to be charged. NECAP have not been charged. Anti-Zionists are winning every week now cases in court. There was recently a case even in the US which has declared that anti-Zionist views are not anti-Semitic and should be protected. So we're winning this battle. And, of course, you know, they may have some victories now and again, but the tide is turning against their ability to impose whatever they want.
And, of course, you've been in the vanguard of that struggle in the UK, haven't you, to make anti-Zionist views a protected characteristic in employment law. But I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today, so I'd like to thank our guest, Tony Gosling, and make a date to join us again on Palestine Declassified next week, when I'll be back alongside David Miller with more revelations and information that you won't find in the corporate media. But until then, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
It's your turn. I'm getting انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. This is a short part of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints on results and outcomes of the uprising of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, peace be upon him. The Master of Martyrs, together with his kin and disciples, were all massacred, but they advanced their ideology. The school did not face defeat, rather it made progress, that is, it defeated the Bani Umayyad forever. The Master of the Martyrs gave his life, but save Islam, the religion that the Bani Umayyad caliphs meant to pervert. God saints to suffer defeat. Imam Ali, peace be upon him, lost a war to a caliph. It goes without saying Imam Hussein was defeated in the war with Yazid and got killed, but in reality he was victorious. The defeat of these men was superficial. Their victory was real.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. About Muharram and the Ashura, Imam Khomeini